This is Fresh Air. Randall Keenan has been called the Black Gabriel Garcia Marquez because of how he weaves folktales, magic, and reality. Keenan's stories are set in the fictional town of Timms Creek, North Carolina, which is modeled on Chinkapin, where he grew up. He was raised by his great aunt on a farm that had been in the family since emancipation. He left home for college, and since then has worked as an assistant editor at Knopf and now teaches at Sarah Lawrence and Columbia. Keenan is working on a travel book about the history of African-American communities in places through North America which are not associated with Black culture. He's the author of the 1989 novel, A Visitation of Spirits, and he has a new collection of short stories called Let the Dead Bury Their Dead. Here's a reading from the first story, Clarence and the Dead, about a boy who gets messages from the dead. This passage is about the boy's birth.
On the day Clarence Bickett died, Wilma Jones's hog, Francis, stopped talking. Now, of course, no one else had ever heard the swine utter word the first. But Wilma swore up and down that the creature had first said to her, Jesus wept, on a sunny day in June. But the peculiar thing was that Wilma had not known of Clarence's death when she declared the hog's final hushing up. And oddly enough, it was on the exact day of Clarence's birth, 5 years before, that Wilma had commenced preaching that the hog could talk. They say that day the sun shone while the rain poured. The old folks say that's when the devil beats his wife. The day Estelle Pickett died, giving birth to Clarence. Her mama was out in the cucumber patch when Estelle went into labor, and we came to get her. Miss Eunice, not being an excitable woman, asked the midwife if it had been sent for. And when we said yeah, she insisted on topping off her bushel before heading home. Estelle's papa, Mr. George Edward, was away in Wilmington that day looking for a new tractor since he was sick and tired of his old farm all breaking down every other row and needing some more oil than gasoline. We never knew if Miss Eunice blamed herself, because she never admitted to it, one, and two, we never saw much sign that she did. We all arrived at the picket place at the same time as the midwife. We walked in on one of the most hideous sights we can remember seeing or hearing tell of. There lay Estelle on the bed, her legs apart, her eyes rolled back in her head, her body kind of twisted to the side, and the pool so deep red it could have been maroon sheet she was sitting on instead of white. And on the floor, squalling like a stuck pig, was Clarence, a twitching, pitiful little thing in a soup of blood and purple mess. There won't no call to worry about being over his face as people come to gossip, just not so. The call seemed to be everywhere else, though, on his head, on his hands, on his belly, like a raw liver, quivery and oozy, him coated in a mucky white paste like snot, a mess enough to make you lose your breakfast. Miss Eunice went to fix him up straight away, and the midwife looked at Estelle. She's gone, child, poor thing, she said.
Whose voice are you reading in? Because it's a different voice than you speak in.
It's a voice very much like the voice I grew up around. The people who brought me up spoke something like that.
Do you end up speaking more like that when you visit your home?
It's strange. It's a strange schizophrenia. When I'm there, I speak that way. When I leave, I drop it very quickly.
So you're bilingual in a way.
Yeah, I'm bilingual in a way.
Did you ever walk in on a scene like the one you described in the end of that reading?
No, I have never walked in on that. I might not be here. I might have expired.
How is the spirit world treated in your family?
Growing up, I heard, not only did people die in every room of the house, but there were stories probably attached to each dead member coming back and conversations and strange goings on. I was an enormously mortified child. I was scared of the dark until I was about 16 years old, and it was a very palpable thing.
Can you give us a sense of one of the stories that would be likely to have scared you?
Stories like the night my great-grandmother died, my great-aunt who brought me up talks about her talking to her after she was dead, not knowing that she was dead, or stories about her father and her mother and brother, all dead, coming back to take care of her when she was sick and didn't leave the house for 3 days, and just, you know, strange signs that let her know Or left her in doubt as to whether or not they were there or whether she was hallucinating. And, you know, a 60-year-old woman telling the story with great conviction to a 5-year-old boy doesn't leave much doubt in the 5-year-old boy's mind that these things are apt to happen.
When you were coming of age and approaching college time, were you drawn, were there conflicting pressures on you to leave and to stay? Was that a difficult decision to make?
Well, I think Toni Morrison probably said it best when she said all black people who realize that they want to succeed in some way, I'll leave that a vague term, know that they have to go away. One of the things that sort of makes Tim's Creek attractive to me is the fact that it is becoming something of a diaspora. It's more people are going away than are living there. More people are dead citizens there than are living. And it was just an understood thing that for me to, when I was in high school, I really wanted to be a physicist. And my first 3 years in college were studying physics. And there was no way I was going to get a job in any research firm in that part of the country. And everybody knew it, but they were very supportive. And implicit in that was the fact that you had to go away.
Mm-hmm. In your novel, the main character's brother and sister had moved north to go to college, and they tell him to get out, and he thinks, well, if we all get out, who will stay?
Right, exactly. It's a horrible dilemma. And as I say, the Keenan family is something of a diaspora. We're strung literally all over the world. I'm talking about the huge extended family, the descendants of my great-great-grandparents. And it is, when we get together, we talk about, you know, all the shared values and that historical time in which, you know, our forebears were very close in that tiny geographical area. And, you know, ideas about how we could all pull it back together. But, of course, that's something of a fantasy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Randall Keenan. His new collection of short stories is called Let the Dead Bury Their Dead. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Randall Keenan is my guest. When was the last time you were back to your hometown of North Carolina?
I go there quite often. In fact, I sort of left New York for the year to do this travel book. And when I'm not on the road, I'm back home.
And who has survived of the people who brought you up?
Well, my great aunt, the one who raised me, not my great great aunt. She, in fact, died in February. A few of the old folk. It's really sort of very sad. A lot of people have died in the last 10 years.
Are there any of the young people in your family left there?
Most of the ones I was closest to are gone. They're either in the big cities of North Carolina, Washington, Atlanta, or New York.
How did you start writing? How did that become important to you?
I had always written. I scribbled down 2 novels when I was in high school. They will never see the light of day, and I will never read them again. But I always... As I said, my mother had taught me to read when I was before I got to kindergarten. So I'd always been in love with words. But growing up in the country, writing was never something I thought I could do as a profession, or, you know, actually make any money at, because you didn't see any writers when you were growing up in Duplin County. So that's how I chose science. And when I got to college, I was thinking, well, I'm going to do what Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke do. I'm going to become a great scientist and write science fiction on the side. And I started studying writing. And I ran into some very formidable teachers who said, well, look, you come from this great heritage. You shouldn't be writing about aliens and Mars. You should be writing about your background and the people you know there. And I resisted. And in that resisting, I read a lot of wonderful works by people like Toni Morrison and Ralph Ellison, and I was won over, and I slowly let the physics melt away, and I wound up becoming, you know, the starving writer in New York.
Curious if it was white teachers or black teachers or both who gave you that advice to write about yourself and your own life and your own culture instead of aliens from outer space.
Both, interestingly enough. Some very, Doris Betts, who's a wonderful novelist and short story writer, Max Steele, Daphne Athis. And actually, the black teachers who encouraged me were critics, literary critics, Lee Green, Trudier Harris. But they, you know, they were very supportive at the same time, it was sort of pulling me away and redirecting me in a very nurturing and loving way.
Was that good advice?
I think so. There's much richer mind feels in, or minds, I should say, not mind feels, even though they can explode in your face, but much richer feels to mind in writing about your own past and that very mystical history that I grew up in southeastern North Carolina.
Does the science fiction part explain, in a way, your interest in the more magical aspects of the culture that you came from?
Undoubtedly. I'm a very recalcitrant human being, and I wasn't going to give up that easily. But at the same time, I have a feeling that they were never really at odds. I mean, I found a way to maintain my interest in manipulating the world, shall we say, or finding another way to look at the world. And so even though I'm not writing about starships and laser guns, I am writing about a type of reality that, you know, you don't see on the 6 o'clock news. But it doesn't eradicate or obviate the 6 o'clock news, but it gives us another way of looking at the 6 o'clock news.
You were at one time thinking of becoming a minister, yes?
It did flit through my mind on occasion, yes.
Oh, and when was that, and why did you want to?
Well, I grew up very much, very, very pious, so to speak. I mean, it was a very strong Baptist tradition. And even now, most of my closest friends are ministers or theologians, oddly enough. I can't explain it because I'm something of a hellraiser. So I have always been fascinated by theology, by the Bible. I was made to learn it thoroughly growing up. And it still holds a certain fascination.
Mm-hmm. How come you didn't become a minister?
Because I'm too much of a hellraiser. No. an ongoing quarrel with Christendom, I think. The church proper, the way it goes about its business.
It expected things of you that you weren't willing to do.
Well, no, not so much of me, but just the way it goes about the business, the way it interprets its mandate, mm-hmm. and the way I interpret its mandate are very much at odds.
Mm-hmm.
And so I prefer to work on the fringes as opposed to becoming a part of the system just yet.
Mm-hmm. Who were the storytellers in your family?
My cousin Norman, Leslie Norman, who lived across the road from me in the house built by my great-great-grandfather, he was probably the most impressive and the most enthralling storyteller I have ever known. And, you know, I was around him literally every day. He took his meals at our house when his wife died. And he was a profound influence on me, language-wise, the way I see the world, the way I think about the dead and that sort of thing.
Randall Keenan, his new collection of short stories, Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, is published by Harcourt Bryce Stefanovich.